Welcome to A Closer Look, a KSKA production that offers insights into the events and people who shape our community. I'm Ellen Lockyer, and today I'm talking to wildlife researcher Vic Van Ballenberg on some new findings he's studying about moose.
Well, I've been in Denali National Park for my fall field season. I've been going to the park every year for 33 years, and this year I was there for 6 weeks and was looking at behavior of moose.
And what behavior are they exhibiting? You've been studying moose now about 35 years, right?
Actually longer, but in Denali for 33 years, yeah.
So, like, what are you looking for? What exactly are you looking for? And can you pinpoint anything that has really, pricked up your interest there this year?
Well, you know, I think most people assume that moose are pretty much identical. And, you know, they're kind of like clones. And what research has found is that they vary greatly. They're far from identical. And they vary in obvious ways, size and color, for example. But they also vary in more subtle ways like behavior. And one way that we've found there's a lot of variation is by following radio-collared cows over many years, we found that some are much more successful at rearing calves than others. You know, we've been able to follow some cows during their entire reproductive lifetime, and we found that during that lifetime, some cows only raise 1 to 2 calves, while others raise 10 or more. So they vary a great deal in that respect. And so, you know, we've been trying to understand what factors account for this large amount of variation.
Does diet, well, first of all, who are we? Do you work with a group or are you on your own? And then I was going to ask, does diet factor into the cow's ability to bear more than 1 or 2 calves?
Well, over the years, I've had quite a few collaborators on the study, people from several different universities, and I've hired technicians, and I've had volunteers, large numbers of volunteers working for me, so it's pretty much been a team effort. Diet is one factor that varies between moose and their ability to efficiently process food is another. You know, some of them can find good places to feed and they're efficient at processing food and others are not. Another factor that may contribute to the successful ability of cows to rear calves is, you know, maybe they're not all producing equal numbers of calves. And we know that in some populations where food is scarce, quite a few of the mature cows don't become pregnant every year. But at Denali, that's not the case. Virtually all of the mature cows get pregnant every year during their peak years, which basically are between the ages of 3 and 12 or 13.
So you're saying that Denali is certainly not an area in which moose are scarce.
No, they're not scarce. In suitable habitat, they're, you know, moderately abundant. What you have to realize is that much of Denali is not suitable moose habitat. A lot of it is, you know, above tree line and moose can't make a living there. But in the areas that do have good habitat, moose are relatively abundant.
So you say, I don't know how many moose you're following, these radio-collared moose. I mean, how long have you been doing this, and what knowledge are you gaining?
Well, we've been doing it for 33 years, and we've had as many as 25 individual cows radio-collared at any one time. And we also follow their associates, so we can learn a little bit about calf production and survival. And, you know, as I started out saying, some cows are much better at raising calves successfully than others. And you know, there's some other possible explanations for that. Maybe some cows are better at avoiding or evading predators. Maybe some produce more milk or higher quality milk. You know, and maybe some find better places to feed. But, you know, those things are kind of hard to sort out. And besides, the differences among cows are only part of the story. Maybe some calves are better able to survive than others. And calves get half of their genes from their fathers, and so it's important to understand something about the bulls that father these calves. And if it's the case that some bulls are more fit than others and cows can detect that, maybe the cows are actually selecting which bulls to mate with.
So is there evidence of that? Do you have a lot of hard data that cows might be selecting?
Actually, we do. And they select in kind of a indirect way. You have to understand what's going on during the rutting season. And first of all, Denali is the ideal place to study this because the population of moose is not hunted. And there's many mature bulls in most places in Alaska where moose are hunted. The mature bulls get shot, and you know, there's only younger bulls left. And so the first thing that we found is that the mature bulls actually do most of the mating, and they do that by excluding the younger bulls through either chasing them away from cows or actually fighting. So the matures do most of the actual mating, and they do it by controlling groups of cows. There's in Denali, for every bull, there's about three cows. And so the cows form groups during the fall, and these groups can average five or six, or sometimes they may be 20 or more. And the cows have several choices regarding those groups. As individuals, they can either join a group or they can remain separate, or if they do join a group, they can leave that group and join another group. The bulls really can't keep them there. And so, you know, these cows have several choices. And what we've learned is that most cows that join groups remain with that group. A small number go off and either join another group or leave groups entirely. And so by choosing groups, that's how they actually choose which bull they potentially can mate with, because it's only the larger dominant mature bulls that control those mating groups.
So is this something new, or is this something that a concept that's been around a while?
Well, it is pretty new. You know, mate choice is one thing that people that study mammals have tried to look into. And there are some mammals that the females will mate with any male at random. You know, they're not exercising much choice. And there's other mammals, like moose, that through these choices that the females make regarding the rutting groups, they exercise some degree of choice over which male they're going to mate with. Now, it's not a direct choosing of a particular male, because when the cows join these groups early in the rut, the bull that's in charge of the group then may not be the bull that persists clear to the end when the cows are ready to mate. But she is ensuring that she is going to mate with a mature, dominant, larger bull, regardless of whether it's the one that's there when she first joins or the one that ends up there, you know, 2 or 3 weeks later.
So maybe if we want more moose calf survival and better moose calves, maybe we shouldn't be killing off the mature bulls.
Well, that is something that biologists have been concerned with for quite a while, and we've gone through periods here in the past in Alaska when we've had some populations where virtually all the older bulls were shot. And so the managers have tried to implement restrictions on what kind of bulls can be shot by putting on, for example, a 50-inch antler spread minimum to try to preserve some of the larger bulls rather than to lose them all to hunters.
So where is your research going, your data going? Are you working toward any particular, program that would, where this research would come into play?
Well, I'm really not in the moose management business, but managers can, of course, read our research results and apply them as they see fit.
You know, as a reporter, and I'm not certainly not any expert on wildlife here, but I end up doing two moose stories. Either, oh my gosh, there's moose all over the place. They in Anchorage, you know, the Wasilla on the highways, they have to be moved, or there's not enough moose to hunt and survive. I mean, there's either a plethora of moose or there's a dearth of moose, and. This is your opinion, but do you attribute that to maybe manipulation of the populations by humans?
Well, there's a whole bunch of different factors that act to limit moose numbers, and hunting is one. We've had some populations here in Alaska in the past that have been heavily hunted and declined as a result, and we've had to implement measures to try to get them back up. Habitat is another. If you don't have good habitat, which means essentially good food and cover, doesn't matter what you do, you're not going to have very many moose. And so it's important to preserve and create good habitat. Another thing that's important are severe winters. In recent years, we've had severe winters in Alaska, and moose have starved in large numbers. Last winter in Anchorage was a record snowfall winter, and I think we lost quite a few moose from the Anchorage population as a result of starvation and also moose being hit by motor vehicles. So, there's several factors that come into play when we talk about factors that control or limit moose numbers.
Yeah, last winter was certainly a heavy snowfall, which was difficult for those animals. I did talk to Fish and Game in the spring about population impacts, and they said they really wouldn't know until the fall when they do the calf survival count and that kind of thing. So that's actually another story I need to get to. So what are you planning to continue with? And I know you've probably, after 33 years, you've probably covered every aspect of moose behavior there is, or do you feel that there's more to know?
Oh, there's always more to know. It's the same with any kind of research, whether it's wildlife research or medical research. And that is, as you complete one study, that raises additional questions, and so you go on to do other studies, and it's a never-ending thing. I've certainly been in the field, thousands of hours, and I've seen a lot of moose behavior, but every year is different, and every study that we complete leads to additional questions and additional studies. So I foresee this going on for a while.
How about climate? This was my question this summer. I mean, it rained and it rained and it rained. Moose were introduced to the Copper River Basin, the Cordova area delta, not the Copper River Basin, the Cordova River area, as far as I know, and it just rains constantly down there, and I guess they did okay. But I wondered about the moose just in Anchorage this summer. I mean, just standing out in that constant downpour. I mean, what kind of effect would that have on their behavior?
We actually had a moose study on the Copper River Delta for 10 years when I was working for the U.S. Forest Service research branch. And yeah, certainly, you know, moose in the coastal areas are subject to a lot of precipitation, and they can handle it. They're pretty well adapted. You know, in the summertime, you probably don't know, but in the summertime, moose develop a really oily coating to their hair. I've radio collared moose and captured them in the summertime, and they're very, very oily, and that's an adaptation to shed water in precip. And so they can handle water really well.
The other thing, you know, our weather is getting so wacky as this past summer and fall has shown us. And I was noting the trees in my area, my block, my backyard. Normally it takes 3-4 weeks. They turn yellow, the leaves dry, they fall down. It takes quite a while before all the leaves, you know, hit the ground, so to speak. This summer, this fall was so weird. Even in early September, the leaves were still brilliant green. There was no yellow as far as I could see. And those big storms did probably speed things along. Everything came down like practically at once in about a 2-week period, which was fine for raking the lawn. But I was watching my willow. I have these two windblown willows in my backyard, and they're really gnarled old storm damaged trees, but the moose love them, and that's why I keep them there, because the moose come in and eat them. They love those willows. Those willow trees were still green until about last weekend, right before it snowed. And usually, you know, they're denuded of leaves along the same time that the other trees lose their leaves. And I'm noticing certain trees are sort of hanging in longer into the fall, green, and I'm just wondering how that. I mean, do those things factor into like moose diet or what? I mean, that's sort of a weird question. But.
Yeah, they do, and we don't really understand very well how that all what that all results in. I can tell you this in Denali, this year. It was the earliest leaf color change that I've seen in 33 years. By the middle of August, the leaves were pretty colorful there, and that's about a week or 10 days early. We've also had other years. I remember 2005, the willows changed color in early August, and that was due more to dry conditions than frost. And we've had years in Denali recently when we've had these big insect outbreaks. The one species of willow in Denali that makes up 50% of the summer diet of moose was hit very hard by an insect outbreak 2 years ago. And virtually every plant over vast areas was, the leaves were killed by this insect outbreak. Now, some of these things are related to climate change. We're definitely undergoing climate change here in Alaska, and those changes in winter severity and onset of spring and onset of fall, they will have impacts on moose, and it'll be interesting to see what they are as time goes on.
Well, yeah, you know, just the other day, I mean, I think, we've been hearing these stories for a while now, but just the last week in our parking lot right out here out back of the building, I saw this bird, and I realized from the silhouette it wasn't a bird from around here. And it's just popping around. It was flying and landing on the tops of the cars, and I actually got pretty close to it, and I realized it was a gray jay. Now, I lived in the Copper Basin for many years, and they're very prolific out there. They're all over the place. They're like chickadees are here. But I've never seen a gray jay in Anchorage, ever. And I've lived here 20 years. And I mentioned that to one of my coworkers, and he who lives on the hillside, and he said, yeah, I see those kind of birds up where I live. But they're moving up. If you ask me, Prince William Sound weather is moving up to Anchorage because, you know, how it's been with the rain and the wind, that's how it is like in Cordova, like all the time. And those things are bound to have impacts on the food sources, like you were just saying, with the trees turning yellow earlier and me saying, well, down here it would seem to me much later. So those shifts are obviously going to have some impact on the diet of these animals.
They will. And as the impacts become more and more apparent, I think we'll see more effort to try to understand what those impacts actually are doing.
Is there any effort to study urban moose calves? Because it seems to me every summer there's a cow with maybe one or two, sometimes twin calves, hanging out on my street. In fact, I swear this one cow had a calf in the lot behind my house because she's very noticeable. She had like a big hole in one side of her, like a softball-sized depression, and it was all sort of black. Other than that, she seemed to be getting along pretty good. But I knew it was the same moose all the time, and I never saw her pregnant. But all of a sudden, one day, she popped up with this tiny wobbly calf in my backyard, and I thought, she must have just dropped that calf, because I had seen her a few days before poking around the willow looking for something to eat. I mean, does anyone study the young moose born right in the city and what becomes of them?
Not that I'm aware of. The managers here, the biologist managers in the springtime handle problem calls, you know, where sometimes bears show up and kill calves, and that's always a cause for concern. And sometimes there's orphan calves that their mothers either wander off or die. And so they address those problems. But actually, in terms of doing research on calves in Anchorage, I'm not aware of any.
That would be interesting, because you see them all the time on the streets. You really wonder what becomes of those animals. And that moose I was mentioning, I saw her down on the bike path later on several times, and they seem to be doing just fine, but I haven't seen her since about June. So we do have in some areas now a bear and wolf predator control, as they euphemistically call it. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we do have a large-scale wolf and bear control program that covers vast areas in several different places in the state. And it's the result of a law that we have called the Intensive Management Law, which was passed in 1994 and really wasn't applied widely until Frank Murkowski was elected in 2002. And then, you know, we began applying the Intensive Management Law over vast areas, and we adopted these wolf and bear control programs. And also what we did was to increase season lengths and bag limits for hunting and trapping in addition to that control program. And so, you know, hunters and trappers had much more ability to take large numbers of bears and wolves. And so those two efforts combined have resulted in a pretty massive effort to reduce wolf and bear numbers over a big portion of the state. And it's been pretty successful in doing that, some areas more so than others. And, you know, in order to accomplish that, we have adopted some measures that I consider to be pretty extreme, you know, things like trapping of bears and hunting bears and wolves the same day hunters are airborne, and, you know, shooting wolves from the air and you know, killing pups in dens. And these things are pretty extreme. Many of them we never did before in the history of wildlife management in Alaska. And I've been pretty critical of those measures because I think, you know, the public, by and large, doesn't really support that kind of extreme approach, even though they might support predator control to produce more moose for hunters. So you know, it's the extreme measures that we've adopted that probably bother me the most.
Your latest research, you publishing this, or is there any place you're going to be publishing it?
Yeah, we over the years we have published a lot of our research results in various places. First of all, in technical journals, we've published many, many papers, and then also in book chapters and symposium proceedings. And so that's kind of the technical end of it. But I've also published a fair amount of stuff in non-technical outlets, magazines. I had an article in National Geographic years ago, and I also published a book called In the Company of Moose, which basically talked about my experiences with moose as a biologist. And I told the stories of some individual moose that we followed for many years in Denali. And so, you know, we continue to publish those results. We had a paper recently that talked about one of these aspects of female behavior during the rut.
Well, yeah, and I was just recalling something occurred to me. I don't know, maybe this is a whole other topic, but, you know, with this predator control, you're telling me that somehow female moose can select the more appropriate male to breed with, I guess. But in artificially manipulating the predators, in killing off the predators that would be killing moose, aren't we sort of weakening the ability of the moose to fend for themselves, and wouldn't that allow maybe weaker bulls to survive? And then that, according to what you're saying about the females choosing a certain bull, wouldn't that sort of undo the female's strategy? Because, you know what I'm saying, they would have only weaker bulls to choose from? Maybe I'm going around in a circle there. I don't know.
Well, over the long term, you know, what you're saying is going to happen over the very long term. Over the short term, and by long term I mean, you know, maybe centuries. Over the short term, you know, in terms of you know, 20 to 30 to 40 years, we don't see those kind of impacts. But clearly, wolf predation on moose over wolf and bear predation on moose over millennia has shaped moose in terms of almost every characteristic that they have. You know, that predation pressure through evolution has created moose that are big and strong and agile and alert, and they have extremely good senses of smell and hearing and sight. And they can run long distances, and all of those things are the net result of heavy predation by bears and wolves on moose. If we remove that predation pressure and we allow the slower, smaller, less fit moose to survive in the long term, you know, we're going to see the results of that.
This has been A Closer Look, a production of APTI News and Public Media. An archived copy of today's program is available on alaskapublic.org. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Thanks for listening.